This is Homefront South Dakota. I'm here with Daryl Christofferson. Where were you living during the war, and how old were you at the time?
I lived in the Navy during the war. I went in the Navy on my 17th birthday, February 12, 1941. And before that, I lived here in Vermilion. I was born and raised here.
What persuaded you to join the Navy?
Friend of mine.
Were you aware of the war that was already going on overseas before Pearl Harbor was attacked?
Oh yeah, I knew they was fighting over in Europe, but like everybody else, nobody ever figured it was gonna be fighting over here too.
Tell me a little bit about your early time in the Navy.
Like I say, I joined the Navy on February 12, 1941, of my 17th birthday, and I took my training at Great Lakes Naval Training Center in Illinois. After training, I was went with a large draft of men. We were sent to California, and we went to Long Beach Naval Receiving Station, and we laid around there for a couple weeks, and then we got orders to the ships that we were going to. The one that I got orders to was the USS Vestal. That at that time I had no idea what it was. It turned out that it was at Pearl Harbor, and it was a repair ship. And we went to, I was put on another ship and rowed that out to Pearl Harbor, and then went aboard the Vestal in Pearl Harbor.
Were you at Pearl Harbor when it was attacked?
Yes. Repair ship I was on was tied up alongside of the Arizona on the morning of the attack. We had went alongside her the day before.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it was a surprise to everybody. Nobody knew what was coming off. Nobody really realized what was happening until the planes come in and they seen the red insignia, the red meatballs on the bottom of the wings. And then they realized they weren't ours, that they were Japanese. And from there, things just continued to get worse. We took two bombs while we was alongside the Arizona. Our skipper was blown over the side. Fortunately, he wasn't hurt. He swam back the gangway and come back aboard. And everybody was back by the gangway, and he wanted to know where everybody's going. They said, the exec said to abandon ship. Then he says, abandon ship, hell, we're going to get underway. And he ordered the engine room to get up enough steam to where they could turn the propellers over. And we cut the lines that had us tied up to the Arizona with fire axes. And we got underway, run across the channel, and run aground on the mud flats over at Aiea Landing to keep from sinking. And then we sat there the rest of the attack.
What was going through your mind during that time?
Not much of anything other than, as a 17-year-old kid, you're wondering what's going on. We knew that we was being attacked, but as far as anything special going through your mind, all you're trying to do is stay out of the way of things and keep from getting shot, or airplanes was straight coming in strafing. You didn't want to get hit by a stray bullet. So we had no guns to shoot back with. So we just tried to stay undercover to where we wouldn't get hit by any stray bullets flying around.
Did all of the men in your group survive?
No, we lost 12 men that got killed when the bombs hit. One bomb hit back aft and went all the way out through the bottom. And that's the one that we lost 12 men when that one hit. The other bomb hit up forward and it exploded down in a storeroom. And we had a bunch of bales of rags down there and it set these rags on fire. And we wound up fighting fire down there. We'd get it put out, and an hour later it'd start burning again. We'd have to go back down and put it out again. And that was what kept us busy more than anything else.
So after the initial attack was over, can you describe for me what happened next?
After the attack, it was just, we had men on there. See, we had, on this repair ship, you have two crews. One of them's a repair force, and one of them a ship's company. I happen to be in ship's company. So after the attack, why, we had boats that we got run around the harbor picking up survivors that was in the water. We'd pick up dead bodies and tow them into the beach where they would be taken care of. Just anything we could do to keep ourselves busy because our ship was not going anyplace. It was sitting on a mud flat and it wasn't going to sink any further. And in the days to come, we built what they call a cofferdam. And you put it down over the bottom and it's pulled up tight against the bottom and covers the hole up where the bomb had went through. And then we get it where we can control the water coming in. And once we did that, boy, then they towed us off of the mud flats that we was on, took us over, put us in dry dock, and we in dry dock we patched the hole ourselves. They give us 24 hours in there to patch the hole in our bottom and get out of there. And we was taken back out and we tied up to a buoy and we swung around that buoy while we worked on our own ship, got it all ready to where it could go to sea. And after we had it ready to go to sea, why, they sent us on out into Pacific. And we hit a couple different islands on the way out. Ships had come in that we'd do some work on. And then we'd go on, we'd stop at another island. The ship would come in and meet us. We'd do some work on it. And we hit places in the Fijis and New Caledonia and several other islands out there in the Pacific that we went into. And we wound up at a place called Espiritu Santos in the New Hebrides. And we wound up spending 2 years there. Just repairing ships when they come in. It actually wasn't a harbor. It was just an area between two islands. And we had one end that we could come in, the other end was too shallow to go out. And we stayed there for 2 years before we got away from there, or before I got away from there. I eventually, after 2 years, got transferred off of the vessel and come back to the States and had the first leave that I'd had since I went in the Navy. Come home. I was home here for about 30 days. And then I went to Norfolk, Virginia, where I was supposed to pick up destroyer escort at Norfolk. But by the time I got there, the amphibious force was just coming into its own, and everybody they had, they was putting in the amphibious force. And I got attached to a crew I tell you, instead of going to destroy your escort, they attached me to a crew that was waiting to go into training for an LST. And there was two of us in that crew that had been to sea before, other than the skipper. And we went through training with that crew there right outside Norfolk, Virginia. And at the end of our training, they sent us to Pittsburgh. There's Neville Shipyard in Pittsburgh, and Mrs. Hines of the Hines variety of pickles and ketchup and that, she sponsored a war bond drive, and they built an LST there at Neville Shipyard. And that's the LST that we was assigned to. We laid around Pittsburgh for 6 weeks, living at Carnegie Tech University. And during the day, they'd take us out to the shipyard, and we'd wander around over the ship. And when it got ready, we put it in commission, and we come down the Monongahela, the Ohio, and the Mississippi River at New Orleans. And at New Orleans, we went back in the shipyard, and they did a little work on us, and we took it outside into the bay for a little shakedown cruise, and was out there one day and come back in. And when they got us ready to go and loaded up, we went across the Gulf of Mexico to the Panama Canal, and went through the Panama Canal and back out into the Pacific. And then eventually we made landings in about three or four different landings there in the Pacific, most of the in the Philippines. And when the war ended, we was running up and down the China Sea waiting to see what was going to happen. And fortunately, the war ended and we didn't have to make a landing in Japan. So,
tell me about your family. How did the war change life for them? Did you have a girlfriend at the time, or was it just your mother at home?
No girlfriends. All my girlfriends was around in the Navy wherever I was at. My folks lived here. My dad worked here in town. Of course, in those days, the wife didn't work. Very few of them did. My mother was home taking care of the family and keeping the house clean and cooking meals and things like that. And one thing I never did find out, and I never did ask, I don't know why, as to what their feelings were. They knew I was at Pearl Harbor. And I never did hear what their feelings were when they knew Pearl Harbor had been bought. And like I say, I never asked. When I got home on leave, why, it was just good to be home. I go to bed at night, and we didn't wake up with bells clanging in our ears at general quarters. We'd be in attack. So it was good to be home then. And after my leave was up, boy, then I got a bus from Vermilion here, and I wound up on train and went to New Orleans. Not New Orleans, Virginia, down to Norfolk, Virginia, and went into the receiving station there and then started all over again.
What became the high and low points of life during the war?
Oh, I think probably the high point was we had been in Espirito Santo so long, and we had been never been to any place where you could get off the ship and pull liberty and go into a city. And they sent us to Sydney, Australia, and we went there for 10 days. And I think that probably was one of the high points. We got 10 days there to do just about anything we wanted to do. And,
so what did you do?
Well, mostly every day you'd go ashore, and always plenty of women you could date, go out with. We had some parties that the ship put on. We'd go to those, and needless to say, there was a lot of booze consumed. That was, in those days, that was the way to go, I guess. Fortunately, I got over it.
Did the war change you?
Well, I'm sure it did. I didn't notice it, but I'm sure that a lot of people did, because like I always say, that when they drop a war on your head, when you're 17, you grow up. You grew up in a hurry.
Did you learn anything about yourself that surprised you?
Oh, I'm sure I did. I don't really, didn't really pay that much attention to it. Like I say, I grew up, and I realized there was more to life than just fighting a war. That after, because I stayed in the Navy after the war. I spent 20 years in there. And through that time, I'm sure there was a lot of changes in growing up, and I got married, had a family, and different things like that.
What was behind your decision to stay in the Navy after the war?
Actually, I got out after the war, come back here, got married. There wasn't anything to do, no jobs to amount to anything that paid your living wage. And I eventually just decided that I was going back in the Navy, and I went to the nearest recruiting office and signed up, went back in the Navy. At least in there, I got a steady paycheck.
After the war was over, was it possible for you to put it behind you completely?
I think so. Not all at one minute, or at one time. You don't, but over a period of time, I think I was able to put it behind me. And there's a lot of things I never thought about until I got where I was speaking to groups about my time in the service and at Pearl Harbor and that, and that helped a lot and put things behind me.
What was some of the hardest to get over? Why do you think it was hard to get over certain things?
Well, before I got married, I think probably some of the hardest things to get over was just the fact that I had spent most of my young life in a Navy that was at war. We spent a lot of time at sea, and after the war we was able to go up on deck and sit up there and smoke a cigarette, have a light. We didn't have to worry about a submarine out there trying to sink us.
Were you in any battles after Pearl Harbor?
Not on the ships I was on. It wasn't where you consider like the cruisers and the battleships and the aircraft carriers out there fighting. No, we didn't have anything like that. On the LSTs, our job was to take a load of men and equipment where they're going to make a landing, like in Lady Gulf in the Philippines. You go in there and hit the beach, and those LSTs, you open up a big bow door, you drop a ramp, and they run all their rolling stock off, and they might be fighting 100 yards or 200 yards ahead of you there. You wasn't involved in it. You were involved in getting all that stuff off the ship, and then if possible, get up, go back, and get out in the harbor there, and when they get everybody unloaded, they'd form a convoy. We'd go someplace else, load up men and equipment, and take them maybe right back to Lady Gulf, maybe to another island where they was going to make a landing. And that was where we come in a lot. And like I say, we didn't get involved in battles like the cruisers and the battleships and the aircraft carriers. They were doing all that type of fighting. Of course, from time to time, these convoys, we would get attacked by submarines and we'd get a ship sunk out there. But we didn't have the problems that they had on the big combat ships.
Tell me a little bit about life at sea.
At sea, on a nice day, you can't ask for anything nicer. I've been out there when the water was just as flat as this tabletop. And the weather out there, the sun shining, and nice cool breeze blowing. And it's just hard to explain how nice it was in weather like that. And then again, I've been out there when the weather was so rough that you couldn't hardly stand by yourself without holding on something. When the weather gets rough like that, and you stay off the main deck as much as possible because waves are coming over the bow, over the side, you get down there and you might have to hang on to a stanchion or something down there to keep it from throwing you around. You get into your bunk and you'd almost have to tie yourself in, keep getting thrown out of your bunk.
What do you want people today to remember about World War II?
Well, as Pearl Harbor survivors is an organization of sailors, servicemen, that survived the attack on Pearl Harbor. Not many of us left. I would have to guess, I'd say right now, there are probably only around 4,000 left. They have a motto that they hope everybody would remember, which is, remember Pearl Harbor. Because it can happen again. So easy. And that's the main thing that we hope people remember.
So. Is there any other stories or anything else you'd like to share with us?
But I got set off on Guam one time. And while I was there, went through a typhoon. And you just can't imagine the force of those winds in a typhoon. Where we was at, most of the living quarters was Quonset huts. And even the mess halls were Quonset huts. And I seen the ends of them blow in. I've seen they had cables on them to hold them down in the wind. And I've seen the wind get them and just move them right across the ground. And you get into stuff like that and you think, boy, what's this poor little boy doing here? But the good times, you want to remember. And the bad times, you just try to forgive. They're always there, but you don't think about them near as much as you do the good times. I was in and out of Pearl Harbor after the war. I spent quite a bit of time on aircraft carriers, and we was in and out of Pearl Harbor an awful lot. And that was before they ever decided to build a memorial. Well, they may have been talking about it, but there wasn't much publicity about it. And I never seen that memorial until about 4 years or so ago, when right after 9/11, I think they was trying to get tourism started again, because Kickin' Radio Station in Sioux Falls was advertising a tour to Hawaiian Islands, and they're taking 15 days, taking five islands, all your transportation, all your lodging furnished. The only thing we had to pay for is our meals. And the price was so cheap on it that I said, we'll never, never get another chance like that. And that is the first time that I seen the Arizona Memorial when we went on that trip.
What was that experience like for you?
It's the most solemn place that you'll ever be. Go aboard that memorial. It's built right over the Arizona. The Arizona still lays there. There's approximately 1,200 servicemen, sailors and Marines still on board that are there. They've never got them out. There's a big, one end of it, there's a big wall up there that's got the names of everybody who died on there. And like I say, you go aboard there, and it's the most solemn place you'll ever be. Men who survived the attack on her, if they would like to be buried there, they'll bury them there. You have to be cremated, and they put you in a canister, and then divers take you down, and they got a place down there that they put these canisters. And the only ones that can be buried like that are survivors of the Arizona. And that gets to be quite a solemn affair. But that's quite an experience, a person never been there, to go there and see that. They have a movie they show you before you go out there. And it's all actual film taken during the attack.
Did you watch the movie?
Yeah.
Was it similar to what you remembered, or was everything so crazy that...
Oh, you mean the movie there, if you've seen
yes,
before?
Yes.
Yeah, I watched that, and they've made movies about Pearl Harbor, and they've done several things that most of it is computerized, and the best one I ever seen is Walmart's had a two CD set out there of Pearl Harbor. And that was not a movie. That was all taken from government film and that they put together and made. And first half was on the CD, was on the attack there at Pearl Harbor. And they also had Japanese film in there. And the second half was what they called search and rescue of some of these ships that were sunk, how they tried to they raised them and how they tried to get people off of them, things like that. And that's the best one I have ever seen.
When you see that film, is it similar to what you remember?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. Because it's actual film taken during the attack. And you see a lot of things there that you remember from there. My ship, we pulled away from the Arizona just as she blew up with the big explosion that just literally destroyed her. And in this, they show several good shots of my ship coming out of the smoke, just getting away from her. There was a lot of little incidents that took place that you forget about them. Like I say, when we went to Norfolk, Virginia, and I was taken off that list for that destroyer escort and put with an LST. I never had any, didn't know what an LST was. I had seen, I think, one or two come into Espirito Santos while I was there, and nobody knew what they were. They looked like a big bathtub. And when they first built them, they figured if they load them up with troops and supplies, and they went in the beach, and they was able to get all those supplies and troops in there. If they never got that chip off sea, off the beach, it paid for itself. And then they found out that they could get them off the beach, so they started building them better, putting more guns on them, bigger crews. And so then they got to where they didn't make a lot of landings. They used a lot of them. On Normandy, there was an awful lot of them. And in the Philippines there, the islands that we went into, why they had a lot of them there. We made a landing in Borneo, a place called Brunei Bay. And we got in there on the beach, the tide went out. The water was from here down to Clark Street back up. We couldn't have got out of there if we wanted to. We had to sit there until the tide come back in where we could float the ship and get back up. So, things like that where it got dangerous because there in Borneo, they had some guy up in the hills there. They had a gun up there that he was lobbing shells down there. We thought he could only hit a certain area until we got in on the beach, and all of a sudden he was dropping them right on us. Nothing you could do to get away.
What was going through your mind in those moments?
Well, we had a saying back in those days. That was, what in the hell is this kid from South Dakota doing here?
Were there a lot of South Dakotans with you?
Not on the ships I was on. You might run into one or two once in a while. But, of course, there might have been, and some of these ships big enough, you know, that you don't go around and ask everybody where you're from. Because there's too many of them, like on these carriers and that. And on the LST I was on, we never, to my knowledge, I never had anybody else from South Dakota around on them. The first LST I got was the one that we picked up in Pittsburgh. And we got to Lady Gulf, and the skipper come up to me one day after we had unloaded and we was anchored out in the bay waiting for a convoy, and he come up to me and he says, how'd you like to transfer to another LST? I'm one of the old sailors around here, been around, the rest of them was all first ship they'd ever been on, and I figured, well, it don't bother me near as much being transferred to another ship, so I took the transfer to another LST. And Skipper by the name of Manuel J. Cordoner was his name. And he didn't want to go in any more landings any more than the rest of us did. And we went in, we were supposed to get loaded up and go on another landing there in the Philippines. And he went in, hit the beach too hard, and after they got us loaded and everything, we couldn't get off the beach. So they made us unload, pulled us off the beach, had us go over to another spot and beach. And I think he fudged a little bit again because we still couldn't get off the beach. So they sent the convoy out without us. My old ship was sunk. When they brought survivors in, another ship, why, I went over to visit with them. And a lot of them were good friends. One of them was a real good friend of mine. He survived it. And he'd always told me he couldn't swim. After the war got started, they used to be, before the war, you had to swim so far before they'd take you in the Navy. But after the war, they didn't care whether you could swim or not. And he never learned how to swim. And I seen him, I said, "I didn't think you could swim." He said, "Well, I'll tell you." He says, "There's a life raft 50 feet out there." He says, "Main deck's just about ready to go underwater." He says, "I don't know how to dog paddle."